You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Hello, and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. I'm Susie Evans, senior editor, and I'm here with
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And Russ Dembin, production editor.
Great. Kind of, Rob is taking a little bit of a break today, so you're stuck with the three of us. He's got better things to do.
Better things to do than this podcast? Oh my God.
I know, right? But he's given us the great duty of taking you through our March issue, which is loosely themed around dance theater.
We'll march right through it.
And we'll take you through that. And after we're done taking you through the March issue, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the trips our staff has gone on. Deep went to the Denver Center for their new play summit, and Russ went to Austin and saw a play there that he's excited to talk about. And then after that, we will talk a little bit about our friends over at the Drama Bookshop, who are undergoing a little bit of a disaster with their water pipe, and there's a lot of good efforts and things that we want to talk about on that front. So without much further ado, let's start by talking about our March issue. Deep, do you want to tell us a little bit about our dance theater package in the March issue?
Yes. Our cover subject for the March issue is dancer slash actor Mikhail Baryshnikov. Our former senior editor Eliza Bent sat down with him last year, and they talked about his newest production called Brodsky Baryshnikov, which is opening at his art center, the Baryshnikov Art Center, in March. And they talked about the difference between dance and theater and his career transitioning from the ballet world. And working with Robert Wilson, because he's worked with was it the old woman? Is it just the old woman, or is there something else too?
That he worked on with Robert Wilson?
Yeah, I think it was just the old woman. Yeah, I think I had gotten mixed up with Willem Dafoe, who's worked with Bob Wilson like two times now.
I mean, like, speaking of the old woman, one of my favorite pieces in this whole issue is the kicker for the story, and I'm going to spoil it for you because it's so great. At the end, Eliza, our former senior, asked him about his pre-show ritual before the old woman, and he just says something so great. He's like, I have to warm up and physically be ready. The makeup for the old woman alone takes an hour. Then I do a two-hour warm-up, so I end up arriving 3 hours before the show. It's a commitment, but it's a pleasure. That's what I do. Otherwise, why bother? Life is too short.
Yes.
It's such a great kicker, and it's such a great ending on a story of someone who's had such a vast career in theater and dance, lest we not forget his amazing guest starring role in Sex and the City, because, you know, that's like his epitomous. That's the wrong word. What's the word I'm looking for?
His most well-known role for women of a certain age.
Yes,
his
there you go.
His trademark role.
There we go. Anyway, that's a great story, and I recommend you read it.
Yes. And our second story in the issue is an overarching story from Calendra Smith, who's a writer in Atlanta, and she talked about resident theaters commissioning smaller dance theater companies from Third Rail Projects, who's been commissioned by the Denver Center. And I actually saw their show, a workshop of it, on Sunday. And Seven Stages commissioning Sean Dorsey Dance and Zacco Dance Theater performing at American Conservatory Theater. It's a thing that is happening, and we investigate why it's happening.
Yes, you'll also notice in this issue a slight change to our front and center section, and we have the introduction of some new elements here. So we have an expanded almanac, as well as our new design corner, where we look at an element of design up close on its own, as well as a roundup of different regions of the nation from each of our five staffers. So you can look forward to that.
Yeah. And I totally forgot that I actually wrote two articles for this issue.
Yeah. What did you write, Susie?
I think this is a good way to transition into our trip segment, because I wrote two stories and both of them involved a trip 3 months ago, but I'm going to talk about it now. I did a story on one of my absolute favorite playwrights. One of my first formative theater going experiences in New York City was to see one of her plays, Becca Brunstetter. She's great. She lives out in LA now. She writes for TV shows. She writes plays. She's super prolific. And she has a new play at South Coast Rep that is running in March. It's called Going to a Place Where You Already Are. And it's about heaven and mortality and faith. And it's a beautiful little play. I haven't seen it. I've only read it. And I went out to LA and got to spend some time with her. And I've been following her work for probably about 7 or 8 years. And we've never actually gotten to meet. So it was really cool to get to meet in person. And it was kind of cool because she knows I've been obsessed with her. And we've emailed and talked on the phone. And it was like, oh my gosh, I know you. But we've actually never had lunch. So we had lunch. And it was a really fun story. And it's, you know, it's, I think she's doing something really interesting on stages that we don't see a lot. Is she kind of writes, she writes young female characters in of like a certain age and like a rom-com-ish. I hesitate to use that word because she doesn't write rom-coms. But like, in a light, emotionally way that you don't see a lot on stage, that you don't see in the classics, that you don't see in a lot of new plays. And I just think it's really interesting. And I also traveled to Chicago to sit down with the new artistic director of Steppenwolf, Anna D. Shapiro, and her longtime collaborator and friend, Tracy Letts, to talk about Tracy's new play that is opening at Steppenwolf at the end of March called Mary Page Marlowe. Six women and a baby play the title character at different stages of her life. And they talked about a new regime for Steppenwolf. They talked about, you know, new plays, and they talked about their collaboration. And that was a really fun conversation that I did in Chicago over the new year. So I went to LA and I went to Chicago, and Deep, you went to Denver. What were you doing in Denver?
Yes, the reason I sound kind of tired today is because I came back on a red eye on Monday. But the reason I was there was that's the location of the Denver Center for the Performing Arts, which is the home of the Denver Center Theater Company. And they've been hosting for the past 11 years a new play summit where they read 4 plays and then they choose 2 of those plays to produce next year on the main stage. So this year's main stage plays were Teresa Rebeck's The Nest and Tanya Saracho's Fade. And I also saw 4 play readings there as well, from Lauren Gunderson, Matt Smart, Jose Cruz Gonzalez, and last person whose name I forgot because I'm not as familiar with her work, Tara Palmquist. And this year they also had an immersive theater workshop on the last day from Third Rail Projects. So that was really fun. And what's interesting about what they do at the Denver Center is they produced quite a bit of plays that you wouldn't think would have come from that place, including The Whale by Samuel Hunter, which was a formative experience that kind of blew my mind when I first saw it at Playwrights Horizons. And then their most recent well-known premiere was The Legend of Georgia McBride by Matthew Lopez, which recently got produced at MCC Theater in New York City. So, and they've done Marcus Gardley. They've done quite a number of contemporary playwrights who we all take for granted. And so this year, the selections were very eclectic. I'm going to be writing about it. Like, Matt Smart wrote about going to Antarctica. Lauren Gunderson wrote about the formation of the First Folio. Jose Cruz Gonzalez wrote about mariachi band. So it was like a wide selection of work and different topics and forms. And so it was just a really fun way to spend a long weekend.
Is it just a weekend, Deep, or is it still going on, or what's the deal?
Before last year, it was only for one weekend. The playwrights, you know, it's the usual model. They come for a week, they work on the plays, and then they read it for an audience. But since last year, they've expanded to 2 weekends, and so they have a week of workshop, and then a reading, and then another week to revise, and then they do the final reading for most of the industry who come in the last weekend.
Do the productions run longer than the workshop?
Yes, the productions run a month.
Are they still running?
Yes. So I'm going to recommend one of them at the end of the show. So stay tuned for that.
Oh my gosh, exciting. And Russ, you were in Austin.
Yes. I was also going to mention that Tanya Saracho's Fade that Deep brought up is the subject of our 20 questions. So you can see 20 questions with Tanya Saracho in our March issue as well. So as we're talking about travel, yes, I was in Austin, and even though I lived there for 2 years, it was my first time seeing a show at the Vortex Repertory Company. So that was That was a great experience.
Why did you live there for 2 years, Russ?
I lived there for 2 years because I'm in a PhD program there. So,
Russ moonlights as a dramaturg, in case no one else knew.
And has a doctorate.
Yes.
I will. I don't yet. I'm,
anyway, I'm keep talking
anyway,
about it.
Anyway, yes.
Wait, doctor of what? Remind me.
Well, technically on the books, it'll be doctor of philosophy, but the degree is performance as public practice.
So Russ is smarter than all of you, and he's going to tell us about this show.
No, maybe someday I will be smarter than you.
Catch up, people.
No, it's all good stuff. So, yes, I was in Austin for a weekend, and I caught the Mikado Reclaimed, presented by The Vortex and created by Generic Ensemble Company. And it was devised by the ensemble directed by KT Shorb. And, this is a really interesting piece for, this current moment. So in the February issue, we had a brief spotlight on two works, both in Austin, that are reclaiming problematic classics. We also have Rudmeck's Timon of Athens. Fixing Timon of Athens. part of Kirkland's and Rudmeck's Fixing Shakespeare series. I saw their first installment, Fixing King John, last year. And this show is also going on, the Mikado Reclaimed. Of course, we've had those troubling instances of yellowface in recent months, a practice that's remarkable that it continues, and we've drawn some additional attention to that. And so this piece, the Mikado Reclaimed, goes into some of those issues in that this is a reimagining of the Mikado, or rather a piece in response to it. So you hear the Mikado Reclaimed, and you might think that it's a scene-by-scene deconstruction of the original Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, but instead it's actually reclaiming the music and doing kind of a riff on it, creating a brand new piece in response to what those songs inspire. So it's a kind of post-apocalyptic world in which a disease has ravished the entire population, and the only people who are immune to this disease that killed off everyone, who are also carriers of this illness, are people of Asian descent. So we have an all-Asian cast and one person of Muslim descent, and so it's an entire cast of color looking at these problematic Gilbert and Sullivan songs, but doing it in such a way that these characters are prisoners in this cell block, and they have been charged with entertainment. So every time the cameras go on, they put on a smile and they do one of these numbers from the Mikado. And it's a really fascinating piece because of the juxtaposition between these lyrics and what's going on behind the scenes. So you have the only English spoken, really, for the most part, is in the Gilbert and Sullivan lyrics. And otherwise we get this whole other narrative about what's going on and punishment and torture, and it makes for a very compelling piece of art.
Well, what was it like plot wise in terms of the original narrative? How did the fantasy Japan come into play?
So the way this piece works, it's more of a response to that world of the play rather than retelling it. So it's almost as though the original narrative isn't there, but there are elements, there are themes from it. So execution figures very prominently in the piece. And it's particularly fascinating to see something that's taken lightly in the original work and really highlighted for the darkness that it is.
Yeah, that's fantastic, because sometimes you think with these classics, you have to put your gloves on and kind of be very gentle with them. But if you can reconstruct them like you do with Chekhov and like a fun experimental way than they'll illuminate the work in.
Yeah. I mean, I saw the Hypocrite's Mikado 2 years ago, and it was a totally different take, but yeah, it was great.
It's also a really great comment on theater for place, because when people are choosing to mount a show, often the questions are, why this play? Why now? And the question that's kind of implicit in that, but doesn't always get asked overtly, is why here? And, with this show, it really spoke to how the community of Austin is an inspiration in how artists approach a work. So, Austin is very political, but really you could do a political piece anywhere. And the nature of being up close and personal, of really delving in deeply to these issues, works particularly well for the Austin theater community.
Right. They have a big experimental theater scene, yes, in Austin, South by Southwest. So I think it's right up their alley to do something like
this. Is it still running, Russ?
Yes. Yes, it is. It runs through this weekend, in fact.
Great. So if you're in Austin and you have time this weekend, go check out the Mikado Reclaimed at the Vortex Theater Company.
Vortex Repertory
Company. At the Vortex Repertory Company. Cool. And then for our final little chat today, we wanted to talk a little bit about our friends over at the Drama Bookshop, who have been getting a lot of attention because they had a pipe burst that destroyed their whole biography section and a lot of out-of-print books. And it kind of, you know, if you don't know, the Drama Bookshop is a bookstore in New York City that sells exclusively books related to the theater, plays, acting editions. They sell a lot of the books we publish at Theater Communications Group. They sell biographies of, theater luminaries. It's very focused. And as you can imagine, that doesn't have a huge market for people looking to buy books other than actors, theater professionals. It's not a lucrative business model, let's say. And so when almost a lot of their inventory gets destroyed by a burst water pipe, like, it's not the greatest situation. And so, Lin-Manuel Miranda of, Hamilton fame, who, little known fact, actually wrote in the Heights in their basement. They have like a basement event space theater.
I've been in there. Yeah.
It's really cool. And so that's kind of like, he did a lot of writing for In the Heights, which was his first show there. He did a Ham for Ham, which is, Hamilton's lottery video entertainment for the show about the Drama Bookshop, telling everyone to buy a book. And he bought a bunch of books. And so, I think it's interesting because, like, just, you guys buy plays? Do you buy books? Is that something that you do?
Only when I'm researching for a play. Though, fun fact, before Christmas, they had the finishing the hat series, the Stephen Sondheim's 2-book coffee table book lyric series on sale. So I finally bought those because I did not own them.
Nice.
Man, you're making me feel guilty for buying those on Amazon right now.
I bought them for half the price of the set. They've created a hashtag on Twitter called buy a book, and so many theater luminaries have rallied around, like, getting them back up on their feet, including TCG, who've offered to replace the titles that we carry at Drama Bookshop for free.
Mm-hmm.
And fun fact, they also carry American Theater, and you can see a big printout of our cover every month in the front, which is really nice of them.
They also do cool things like they have like playwrights writing in their window sometimes. Mm-hmm. So you can see a playwright working. It really, and they have a Tony Award. They got an honorary Tony for being a fixture of the theater community. I mean, they are based in New York, but you can buy books online, and they're one of the few exclusively theater bookshops in the world. And I think if you're not in New York, I think it's important to support theater everywhere, and you can order them online. It's like supporting a small book business. And so I like reading stuff on my Kindle, and I like reading things on my iPad. But when it comes to reading plays, I actually very much prefer doing it on the page. I can do books on my Kindle, but I don't like reading plays on my Kindle. I like reading them in a book. So if you're like me and you like that, also if you're an actor and you need to highlight lines and stuff, like, you can't do it on a Kindle, or maybe you can, but it's harder. Russ.
Yeah, and Drama Bookshop also has cool events such as next month, if it's still on, there will be the annual Brilliance of the American Theater reading held by the American Theater and Drama Society. That'll be March 24th if that's still happening. So there are cool events that happen at the Drama Bookshop as well.
Yeah, if you're based in New York, you should totally check those out. Anyway, hashtag buy a book. If there's books you've been meaning to get on Amazon or there, whatever, don't get them on Amazon like me. Get them at the Drawn Bookshop. Yeah, and just support them. It's great that we have people who are doing this sort of thing, and I think they're an important place for people, not just in New York, but across the country. And now, without further ado, we're going to go into our interview portion of this podcast. During Theater Communications Group board meeting, we had our whole board in town, and we had the opportunity to sit down with Megan Pressman, who is the managing director of Woolly Mammoth Theater Company in D.C. Megan is on our board. She is also on the planning committee for TCG's national conference, which will be in DC this June. And Rob, our editor-in-chief, sat down with Megan to talk about new play development at the Woolly and her role. She's been there a little bit over a year, I think. She was at Signature Theater before as the director of development. Yeah, and it's a great conversation. So enjoy that, and then we'll be back with recommendations after it's over.
So Megan, how are you?
Good, Rob.
I know we've met many times at the conferences over the years. In fact, I was looking back a little bit, and it was a conference speech that Howard gave in Boston.
2012, yeah.
In 2012, which really struck me at the time. In fact, I had my own personal blog, and I wrote a blog post about how much that speech impressed me, about innovation, about breaking up the way that theaters usually produce work. And I know that that's been part of what your career has been about, right? It's been producing work in new ways. Is that right? Would that be safe to say?
It seems to have evolved that way.
Yeah.
Yes, I've had a lot of good luck and fortune working on new plays and new play production. So I right before that speech, or as that speech was happening, I was still working at Berkeley Rep on the ground floor, and that was our first summer of the ground floor, and that's
right.
Their center for new play production,
yeah.
And that was all about finding different ways to workshop and commit to new plays and playwrights.
Right.
And that summer, I was in the middle of transitioning to Signature Theater,
okay.
in New York, which again is also about really innovative ways about partnering with playwrights and their body of work and producing new plays. And a Howard speech came at a really important time for me too, in between those two jobs, and
right.
That was my first introduction to Howard Shulwitz.
Great. And so now, going back in your own, you're from New York originally. As
I am. I grew up in Manhattan.
Right. I think we've talked about that. And
yeah.
But then you went to Yale. No, it was Northwestern.
Actually, I went to Boston College. Amazingly
keep up
enough, my parents couldn't keep track either. I went to Boston College for undergrad, where I majored in theater and minored in education. But
okay.
That was not my plan. I actually started school as a chemistry and math enrolled double major.
Okay,
sidestep into theater, and then I was at Northwestern for a 1 year master's program after undergrad, and
okay.
Then I took a few years off working in theater in Chicago, and
okay.
then wound up at Yale for the theater management program, and then stayed to do the joint degree MBA. So I've had plenty of time in higher education.
And
yeah.
You know, you're someone I think of as, because of these various places you've worked, you did some time in the Chicago theater scene, you've worked in San Francisco, the Bay Area, and you've worked
New York for a couple of years,
and DC. Now, I mean, you have a sense of the whole theater field in a way that, I mean.
Well, certainly those areas, but, you know, and by proximity, some of the other areas that they're, you know, so I have a better sense of the LA theater scene, certainly, than I did before I worked in Berkeley.
Right, right.
By virtue of some proximity.
Right, right, right.
And Boston also, to some degree, because I was
and
in school
that,
there.
I mean, when you sit in we're talking to you because you're in town for the TCG board meeting. And you've been on the board for a while now, but
no, I just started this. I know.
Oh, really?
I just started this winter, or I guess November was my first meeting.
I feel like you've been in the TCG fold for so long.
I have. That is true.
But so you're new on the board. I mean, do you feel like a lot of the issues and concerns that are brought up in the board and the areas of leadership are ones that are very familiar to you from the various theaters that you've worked at?
So far, absolutely. It's one of the great things about being in that room. The few times I have now is seeing reflected in that room the things that we're talking about regionally. You know, where I am specifically now and where I've also worked.
Right.
So it's very fulfilling and great to see those questions filter all the way up to our conversations.
Now you came into the signature theater at a time when it was transitioning, right? When it just opened the new space, right?
It had been open just probably about 6 months by the time I got there. Right. So yes, a lot of transition happening at that company. Still, even a couple of years later, of course.
Yeah, I mean the leadership transition. But one thing about Signature that's interesting to me was they had such a clear brand before of the one playwright
mm-hmm.
per season, and they would sort of occasionally do legacy playwrights, and now. I'm so supportive of the vision of how many of doing so many more new plays, but I can't keep track of who's who they have on the fold and who they don't.
Well, the expansions was a really interesting thing that we talked about a lot as senior staff, and that I know Jim was really thoughtful about. And I think the some of the re-messaging we had to do was really going back to our core supporters, our board members, our own staff, and reminding folks that the whole mission there is to honor and celebrate the playwright.
Right.
And the way that was executed for so many years was this well-known one playwright, one season thing. But that ultimately is not the mission of the company. And what Jim was trying to push and evolve was another way in which we can honor and celebrate the playwright is giving them an artistic home. So that's where this new dedication to emerging and mid-career playwrights, five-year tenure idea came from. But it became all of a sudden, you know, a messaging challenge to solve. How do we continue to have this one playwright, one season core model?
Right.
And make sure people still understand what we do and how we value playwrights and what we're presenting when this season you could see eight different playwrights on our
stages.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. And next season some of them will be there and some
of them
won't.
Yeah. Yes.
I think it's all kind of win-win as a theater mm-hmm. consumer, theater fan. It was less clear. Now tell me, Wooly has a really clear brand as I've told you before, I've seen one play there, but we feel like we follow because some of the plays, I don't know, is Wooly part of the National New Play Network?
We are actually, their offices are in our lower lobby.
That's right.
we were a founding core member and are still close with them.
So the plays that go through there, either through the NNPN officially, but a lot of them have productions elsewhere. They come from productions. Wooly seems to be very much a part of the new play.
Wooly has been. I mean, pretty much for, you know, the most of its adult life, this is Wooly's 36th season. So I'd say its identity for at least the past couple decades has been a new play theater. Before it was, I'd say, hip and cool to do new plays as it is these days. And we basically use the same definition of a new play that the New Play Network and others do, which is that it's in its kind of first, second, or third iteration.
Right.
The playwright often is still working on it, even if it's the second or third time out and they're in residence. So of the four plays that we produce from scratch a year, most of them fit into that definition. So we've really been focusing on new plays the whole time. Some of them, only, you know, a handful over the years have been formal rolling world premieres with the New Play Network, but all of them tend to be still new plays.
Right. I mean, for us, it's a question we always have when we're doing our statistics about what's new and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
But we sort of informally just say it's like in the last 5 years. Now, there's some plays like mm-hmm. Vanya and Sonia that's been locked and has a million productions.
Right, and it's locked in pretty quickly.
I mean, it's still a pretty new play. And for a lot of the country, it's brand new. Mm-hmm. It's still brand new.
So, yeah, and you said you saw Clybourne Park there a number of years ago. We actually did the second production of Clybourne Park, but we committed to the script before it had been produced.
Right, okay.
And then Bruce was still working on it, and the production that we did is I believe, the version that is, you know, the changes he made by that point was the version that's now published. Very new play is very much obviously still in transition.
Interesting.
And that we see that happen a lot, where we'll commit to a show and just by virtue of calendar we may or may not be the official world premiere.
Right.
And that happens for a lot of us and our peers, is that we're all, you know, it's a play, gets finished and it gets sent out and a bunch of people get excited about it. We all produce it when it's the right time.
But it seems like sort of an arms race, so you all have to sort of disarm at the same time to say, like, look, this whole world premiere thing, like, can we just agree that it's a new play and it's mm-hmm. exciting, it's new, for it's a premiere for our, I know world premieritis is a big part of...
Well, just some of the brilliance behind the idea of this rolling world premiere, the blessing and permission to call something what it actually is, still a world premiere play.
Totally.
And getting away from some of those less attractive monikers like East Coast premiere, that which we realize the audience doesn't really care about.
I know. Or like regional premiere, right? What does that mean? You know, or Northern California premiere. Right. I always like those. Right. You know, like because it's been done in L.A. or somewhere else, or Central California.
The marketing team does not like those.
So your title is managing director, but it sounds like you're sort of what in other theaters might be called an artistic producer. Would that be fair to say, or no? You're pretty.
I'm still fairly on the managing executive director side. Because of my background and interest, I think, in new plays and the fact that I have a lot of history in that area and relationships with playwrights and artists, I perhaps am a little bit more involved in season planning than maybe other folks in my role.
Right.
So I still get the fortune to scouting shows occasionally. I'm obviously not the front line. I will see shows and sometimes I'm, I'm part of that room. So that, to that extent, I'm acting in so much of an artistic, part of that team.
Okay. I don't know exactly how all those job descriptions shake out exactly. Different theaters.
I think it's different everywhere.
For theaters that emphasize new work, it's a different job too, isn't it? As opposed to.
In some ways, I mean, a lot of the equations are different. So, with a new play, we're not relying on a box office name or prior reviews. So in many ways, our job is to figure out different ways to create relationships with the audience and with our artists when you can't just use, prior knowledge of a piece of work.
Right.
So I'd say that changes the way we concentrate our time, but ultimately the functions are still very much the same: fundraising, development, marketing, facilities, operations.
Well, let me ask about the Free the Beast program and then maybe how it differs from, I mean, I know Ground Floor, you said had its own innovative approaches, but Free the Beast, tell me what that is.
Sure. Free the Beast is was a fundraising campaign for basically new play development money that Wooly started. We're now in our fourth year of spending. So the actual effort got launched probably 6 or so years ago.
Okay.
And the intention behind it was to raise money that we would spend over the course of a 10-year period. So again, we're in year four, which would help us dedicate to more funds and resources to new play development, recognizing that developing a new play takes more work often than just mounting a play that's already been fixed in time or re-envisioning a classic.
Right.
So part of Howard's speech that you mentioned earlier in 2012 was something we talk about, words we talk about a lot at Wooly are getting off the assembly line.
Yeah.
The idea that every play, for some reason, needs the same amount of 3 weeks rehearsal, 1 week of tech, and then performances is a little crazy. They're all very different pieces. They range greatly in cast size. So that every play, whether or not they're new or not, only needs that 3 weeks rehearsal is an insane notion to begin with.
Right.
But the idea that those of us who work in the new play field recognize that plays take a lot of work, and right now it's certainly in vogue to have that work include workshops and readings and really more people than just sending off the playwrights or the woods to work alone.
Right.
So the Ground Floor certainly acknowledged that at Berkeley. One of the things they're doing is giving playwrights different resources in their development process without the pressure of a production. So be it a reading or a writing retreat or a workshop with actors and directors or even designers, it's you're going to need some development phases before you want to go into production. And this will make the work more, to just get it farther. So Wooly also recognized that, but what we didn't have was a lot of resources beyond producing the plays. So couldn't, it took a big extra effort or grant or special opportunity to go do a workshop of a play or bring in the artists early to work on it. So Free the Beast is supposed to change all that for us. And we're in year four and we've really seen a lot of differences. So it's the way we're spending that money, we raised about $3 million that we get to divide over 10 years. We're now able to commission shows more regularly. That was an infrequent occurrence before. We would work with new plays all the time, but actually commissioning them was something that, as a smaller company, we didn't have the resources to do.
Okay.
We are able to commit to larger shows or more technically complex shows than we maybe would. So some of our Free the Beast money can go straight to production when we would normally in the past have said, oh my gosh, it's a 12 to 14 person cast and it needs video projections.
We can't.
Sure. Now we can say we can because that's a Free the Beast expense that we can support.
Right.
And then the idea of workshops and development time. So adding an extra week of rehearsal, doing a workshop 6 months in advance, finding other ways to support the playwright development work is all the ways in which we're using that money. And we've had, you know, the idea was to have it support. It changed over the years, you know, anywhere up to 25 new plays over the course of the 10 years or 10 commissions or, you know, what it basically is doing is it's supporting most of the work that we do.
Right. I mean, it sounds like the idea wasn't necessarily to have one new model as opposed to that 3 week, you know, that short rehearsal time. So there's all different models is part of your job to go, okay, we need to have some sort of like predictable way that the budget's going to work every year, or is it going to be just a different one for every play?
There are some things that are predictable, but I think one of Wooly's strengths is not being predictable and changing things up and continuing to be flexible. Something that's worked for a couple years or for a couple shows, it's the whole point is that there is no cookie cutter pattern.
Right.
But it's great. It means we get to have real conversations with the authors and say, what do you feel like you need? Do you need another couple workshops before we commit to producing this show? How much more time is it going to need? And can we kind of commit to it a season from now? There's some stuff that we do.
Seem to recall that there, maybe this was not part of the Free to Beast program, but like an emphasis on resident artists or associate artists or folks who could be around.
We do have some stuff around that. It's not necessarily Free to Beast funded in all cases. And so we just started kind of a company artist lab process, which is supported by Free the Beast.
Okay.
We actually have Shauna Cooper is our director in residence, supported by a TCG, the Leadership U Grant. And that's the evolution of what was formerly the New Generations program, which is how I started at Berkeley, was a New Gen grantee, which is why it feels like I've been around TCG forever.
Sure.
But Shauna's been really great. We get her for roughly 18 months in residence, and part of her work and part of her attraction to Wooly was actually going back to that same assembly line speech that she saw Howard do, and they connected after that. She's really interested in non-traditional rehearsal hall methods and how do you build a community of artists at a place that doesn't have necessarily a full-time Oregon Shakespeare style company.
So
one of the things that Shauna has been working on with us is creating some lab work is what we're calling it, where we'll get a bunch of artists in the room for a week to not necessarily work on the production of a play, but work on our evolving vocabulary of the rehearsal process. It's been really rejuvenating for those folks. So that's right now a new evolution of what we're playing with. We do have artists associated with Wooly in a company. So they're not like Trinity Rep's company where they're paid full year, but they're artists who are closer to the family. There's a bunch of actors, some playwrights, some directors.
Yuri Yurinov is one of
our directors and designers. So we go to them first.
Because I know one of the other critiques that Howard didn't take on directly, but it was sort of implied that one of the critiques of that whole job in people for a few weeks and then go away, then reassemble them for another play is that, you know, it'd be great to have a sort of, as you say, a community of artists who work together regularly. And, you know, bring in new ones and bring in new people. Don't just have to be a homogenized group, but, you know, have some sort of continuity with the company, right?
And, you know, it's also going to the idea that when we commit to new plays, often the first people in the conversation are playwrights, if it's really a new play, and the director, who's usually the first person you hire, and it'll be months before designers get near that project, and then months before actors get near that project. And is that the right thing to do is a question we're looking at.
Okay.
Those other artists are generative, brilliant artists in their own right, but we're bringing them into a process way late in the game to influence it.
Yeah.
So some of the reasons why we're interested in these workshops and this company work is that, Misha Koshman, for example, is a set designer that we work with really frequently. He has great relationships with people like Yuri and Howard, and he's designing our production right now. And as soon as we attach him to a project, those conversations start.
Right.
Outside of your normal kind of quote unquote design process you know, it's outside of the way those deadlines typically work because these relationships exist and he gets to become a key player immediately in the development of the vision of the piece.
Right.
And that's true for our other, I think, designers as well.
I want to zoom out just really quickly and ask you a few more questions. What, on the one hand, excites you the most about the field in general and what worries you the most about the field meaning, you know, theater, nonprofit theater.
Perhaps I'm influenced by the timing of your question coming from this board meeting where we just had a lot of great conversation, you know, continuing the equity, diversity, and inclusion work that TCG is doing and also bringing to the board level. And that's part of both kind of to the heart of what excites me and also terrifies me a little bit at what's happening at the field level. I love the focus we're putting right now on, you know, gender parity. We just did this Women's Voices Festival in DC, and right. that was a really important moment, I think, for everybody. The focus on all of educating ourselves how to even have the conversations around equity, diversity, and inclusion. How do we do that? What's okay? What's not? I think that's so important right now.
Right.
On the flip side, especially at a company like Woolly, where being provocative is really part of our kind of core identity, part of what worries me is that in this trend, the important trend of being careful,
yeah.
we're going to lose the ability to also be provocative.
Right, right.
And I think that's as broad as I can go, go with it. But it is a little bit of a fear I have is how do we continue to push the envelope if we're really afraid of offending people.
Right,
and
right.
so how do we become more educated so that we know what is offensive and what isn't and right. what is pushing the envelope in an appropriate way and what isn't is what's in danger from being right now.
Right. It's a push-pull between artistic freedom and sort of responsibility.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, it's along a lot of different areas. That's a tension. Ending on a more positive note, what if you plug, what are you excited about at Woolly coming up?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
We have a really great spring coming up. We're doing three shows back to back that, oddly enough for Woolly did see time in New York. It's weird for us to have that many in a row, but we have Guards at the Taj by Rajiv Joseph.
Great fun.
Which is great fun. Following that up with, Jennifer Haley's The Nether, which Shauna Cooper's directing, which, also had a run in New York and in London before that.
And in LA,
yes, that's yes. right. And then we're ending the season with An Octoroon, which by Brandon Jacob Jenkins.
You've heard of that one.
Yeah, I'm sure you have.
Who's directing it for you?
Nataki Garrett, which is our first time working with her. She's the head of the directing program in Long Beach, I believe.
Okay.
And she's great. We've wanted to work with her for a while. We have a history with Brandon, and we, you know, as soon as that play got written, that was one of those, well, obviously we have to do it in D.C., and who else would do it?
Yeah, yeah.
And we're both excited and terrified by what that conversations that show will bring.
Indeed. I mean, I was going to make that last question, but I'm wondering, I didn't ask you much about being in D.C. and what that feels like, the audience there. And how does it feel different from the New York audience? Does it feel more politically engaged just because
Yes. I mean, it's certainly more politically engaged. They really welcome the shows that have a civic dialogue bent to them.
Right.
You know, of course, it's an incredibly educated community. I find more in common with what I found in Berkeley audiences than I do a little bit in New York, just because New York audiences are in some ways more diverse, across all sorts of interests and area.
Right, right.
Not at all to paint them as not civically engaged or not, higher education, but you'll just find more diversity.
And I have heard that Berkeley Rep is very just super educated.
Super educated, super political, love cutting edge stuff at the same time. Yeah. And that feels very familiar to me in D.C.
You see a lot of elected officials in the audience?
We do sometimes. Yeah. We had some Supreme Court judges okay. come out to see the Elevator Repair Service production of Arguendo last year, a couple of years ago, I guess, which was, you know, about a Supreme Court case, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg did a little panel for us. So it could happen. Yeah.
And did they like that? They like the mm-hmm. depiction
absolutely.
Of their
yeah.
work.
yeah.
What's the one that Arena did, the play about Scalia?
Scalia, yeah.
Did he ever go to, you know?
I heard he did, but I can't confirm that.
Okay, interesting.
But, yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah, you'll certainly, that happens, where we'll have those kind of levels of
oh, my God, what was the zombie play?
Zombie the American?
Was set in the White House, right?
It was, with zombies living in the basement.
Did you have some White House staffers come to that one, or?
We actually had some staffers come. We had somebody, I think, from their press office came to see it. It was a little bit of a harder sell to some of the more conservative ones.
I would imagine.
But, that's part of what's fun about being in DC is that your proximity to those national level influencers is, you know, it's so close.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah. Megan, it was great to catch up with you. I need to catch a train back to D.C., but it was great to talk, and hope to see you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you. Welcome back.
we hope you enjoyed that interview. Very enlightening. And we're here to give you some recommendations and a little added discussion since we've all seen one of the same shows. So we'll start with that. Russ, what do you recommend?
I recommend Nice Fish, which is playing at St. Anne's Warehouse and originated at American Repertory Theater, or at least this production did. It did have a previous staging at the Guthrie, but this new version, they commissioned it. And this new version, which includes a number of adjustments, premiered at American Repertory Theater in Massachusetts, and now it is in New York City.
No, wait! All three of us have seen that show. Aha. Maybe we should discuss some things.
Oh, and it's running until March 27th.
Yes.
And we did an we have an interview with Mark Rylance, the famed Shakespeare actor who is actually from Minnesota.
Yeah, he grew up in Minnesota.
Well, he was born in Wisconsin.
No, he was born in England. But he has spent much of his childhood in Wisconsin.
Okay. So Mark Rylance, the famed Shakespeare actor, who was born in England and spent a lot of his childhood in Wisconsin, wrote the play with his favorite poet, Louis Jenkins, who you probably know from his Tony Award acceptance speeches when he gets on stage and recites poetry. Anyway, Russ, you're recommending the show. What did you think of it?
I was excited for this show because in fact checking our story, I developed a new love for his Tony acceptance performances of the Louis Jenkins material. And so I was excited to see how this would play out on the stage. And the great thing about Louis Jenkins's poetry in combination with Mark Rylance is that Rylance's delivery really makes it sound very conversational. And Rylance has commented that when people heard the Tony speeches, they thought that it was just coming up organically.
Yeah. Well, cause they're prose poems.
Yes.
So with a good actor, you can make them sound conversational. They're not verse.
Right. And not all of the dialogue in the play is poems.
Right.
A large portion of it. I mean, I'll be frank. I don't usually like shows like this. I like shows that have a straightforward narrative. And then this is kind of a vignette-y performance. There's lots of blackouts between little scenes that are monologues,
yes,
recitations of poems. But it's kind of a gorgeous meditation on life. These poems are like very heartfelt and they like pierce your soul. And it's about this ice fisherman in Wisconsin or Minnesota. Where is
Minnesota? They're in Minnesota, but Rylance's character is from Wisconsin.
Okay. So yeah. Rylance isn't the ice fisher. He's come with his friend to this ice fishing in Minnesota. And there's a few other characters that come in and they just kind of are like sitting on the ice. And it's a cool set.
Musing on life, and it's kind of Godot-like insofar as it's just these two people not really doing much and thinking about their own lives, but instead of using Zap Beckett, it's Louis Jenkins's poetry.
Exactly. It's fun, and if you're in New York, you can see it at St. Anne's Warehouse, and they have a gorgeous new space that is very worth checking out.
And the set is
gorgeous.
Gorgeous.
The set is very cool.
Yeah, there's like a forced perspective thing going on with the background, and you see like little cars driving by, and
cool. So we've all seen it. It's worth checking out if you can. Deep, what do you recommend?
I'm going to recommend two things. First is Fade by Tanya Saracho, which is playing through March 13th at the Denver Center. And this morning I was on the train and I was reading the New York Times, interviews with a bunch of Hollywood actors, producers, directors talking about what it's like working in Hollywood when you're not a straight white man.
Oh, I have that bookmarked. I want to read that so bad.
Oh my God. And it's all those things you know happens, but it's just so refreshing to actually see big name celebrities like Julia Roberts and America Ferrera actually talk about like how they've been judged or diminished because of their background. Anyhow, back to the play. The play is based on Tanya's experience writing on TV for shows like Girls and Looking, and how as a diversity hire, she's not taken seriously. There's a fictional character in the play. Her name's Lucia, and she starts up a relationship / friendship with the janitor because he's the only other Latino person in the building. And it's them going back and forth about their life experiences and her frustrations at work because the only time that they want to feature Latino characters are as stereotypes, and her trying to broaden the executive's expectations and then unfortunately kind of succumbing to some of that in order to get something produced that's mildly authentic. Hopefully I'm not spoiling this play for anyone, but it raises up a good amount of questions about representation. And then there's also the question of, if you're in this position as the only person of color, what compromises you have to make in order to get something produced, which kind of spoke to that New York Times article as well. It's all very messy, depressing business, but it's a good play.
And read the New York Times article, because apparently it's good.
Yes. Oh, and one other thing that I wanted to recommend really quickly is I'm also reading Joel Grey's autobiography, Master of Ceremonies. I'm halfway through, and I'm getting to the part where he talked about his first three-way, which... now I know way too much about Joel Grey, but he did a really great interview on NPR with Fresh Air's Terry Gross, and you should just listen to it because he sings Home on the Range in Yiddish, and it's wonderful.
And little known fact, Joel Grey's Yiddish roots, he comes by them honestly because he is the son of a great Yiddish theater performer, Mickey Katz.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Cool. And I am going to recommend a play that I was very surprised by and loved. I saw Smokefall at MCC Theater, which is originated at the Goodman Theater. I think it played in their smaller space first and then transferred to the larger space. It's written by... Deep, you want to say something?
Yes. Oh, well, it's written by Noah Hadle, but it actually originally a South Coast rep, because I saw the reading 4 years ago at the Pacific Playwrights Festival, and I kid you not, I was in tears.
So it started at the Pacific Playwrights Festival, and then it had two productions at the Goodman, as both in their smaller space and their bigger space, and now it's in New York at MCC. It's by Noah Hadle, a playwright I hadn't heard of until now, and directed by Ann Kaufman. And it's kind of Tennessee Williams-esque and gorgeous. It's a family drama, but it's a little bit magical. Mm-hmm. And I have honestly only seen Zachary Quinto on stage. I've never seen any of his like big movie work that everyone else knows him for. And he is just one of our greatest stage actors. And his performance in this show is so moving and so gorgeous. He kind of plays this narrator character who, it's kind of like Tom in Glass Menagerie. I mean, he kind of like narrates the story and he's part of the story. There's a weird scene in the middle that I'm not going to spoil, but then it's like very realistic and not and fantastical, and you'll just meditate in your life and be in tears. And like, I went with someone, and we both got something totally different out of it. And I'm not going to say what it is because it'll spoil it, but there's something for everyone. And I think everyone can kind of see their life or their emotions in this weird, It's very cool. If you're a philosophy doctor or us, there's a little philosophy meditation in the middle of it. You know, it's a beautiful play and a great production. I had a really good time. So you should check out Noah Hadle's Smokefall.
Is Sendin' the Clowns still a plot device?
Yes, Sendin' the Clowns is still a plot device.
Awesome.
Zachary Quinto sings a little bit of Sendin' the Clowns, if that's enticement for you to go see it. Anyway, unless... Russ, you have something else?
I have a quick correction. I said that Mickey Katz was a Yiddish theater performer. He was a Yiddish performer of comedic parodies, but he was not in the Yiddish theater. So apologies for the error.
That sounds exactly like what a Yiddish theater performer is.
Well, there was the Yiddish theater, which is different.
Like vaudeville? Like, because he was a traveling musician, from what I remembered so far, what I've read.
Yeah, I just didn't want to suggest that he was part of the traditional Yiddish theater movement, which I don't think was the case.
But the funny thing is, though, Joel Grey doesn't actually speak Yiddish.
Yiddish.
Yeah. I cannot pronounce words. I'm still jet lagged.
Anyway, and on that note, that's our show for this week. Thanks so much for listening. If you like us, don't forget to rate us on iTunes or subscribe. It helps people find us and learn more about the theater. And check in again in 2 weeks.